This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
This is 5 Live Friday afternoon. Mark Kermode in place, in position. Hopefully he's seen the odd movie or two.
Well, that's my job, Simon.
OK, well, you know, just checking. And Rory Cochrane is here, who stars in a new movie, Right at Your Door, which I think is out next week.
I believe so.
Though, frankly, I'd have walked past you on the street. You haven't got any hair. It's all gone.
Yeah, I'm doing a thing up there. It's a miniseries about the CIA and the... it's a Ridley Scott miniseries about the CIA and KGB.
A Ridley Scott miniseries?
Yeah, he's producing it. So we all, sort of the main actors, have to shave their heads because they put wigs on you because you age over 40 years.
Right. Are you feeling sleepy?
I just got off a plane this morning, and I worked till 5 in the morning last night, so...
A little bit of jet lag.
A lot of jet lag.
Explain the idea, the rather terrifying idea behind Right at Your Door, right?
The idea, I think, for the picture is not to sort of exploit people's fears about this terrorism thing. I mean, I think terrorism obviously has been going on for hundreds of years. It's just... basically a human story between a man and a woman dealing with that's the backdrop would be the dirty bombs going off. But I mean,
you're assuming that we know about it. We don't know anything about the plot. So, before we get to what it's really
about. You're in England, assume we know nothing.
Okay, so before we get to what it's really about, which is the relationship between you and your wife and the other guy. So the first thing that happens in this picture is...
I sort of play this out-of-work, deadbeat musician who's living off his breadwinning wife. I send her off to work in the morning with a kiss and so forth, regular day, and then these dirty bombs go off, and there's a lot of chaotic activity that ensues after that, and a lot of miscommunication from the radio and the authorities.
Right. And so you're at home?
I'm at home.
And your wife comes back?
Then she comes back, and after a series of events, it's broadcast that you're not supposed to come in contact with anybody who's been exposed to these dirty bombs because you're at risk then, too. So I don't let her in the house. So that sort of makes for an awkward situation.
Yes, I can imagine. I can imagine that it would. Why would you not, even if... So you're a loving couple, yes?
You've
just moved to the area, so you love your wife and she loves you. Why would you not... let your wife, even if you thought you might get contaminated?
Well, I mean, if you found out, let's say, for example, that your wife was HIV positive and you weren't, and she wanted to have sex with you, would you have sex with her?
I'll leave.
I'm asking you.
I understand the conundrum that you're portraying. I'm just saying this is this is an immediate dilemma that you have to face, isn't it? Open the door.
Right. I mean, most people would, and I think that's, or at least they say they would, until they were faced with that situation, which hopefully they would never be faced with that situation. But I think it definitely brings up a lot of coffee shop talk. And I think if couples go see this movie, they'll definitely, you know, have to be like, sure, honey, I'd let you in.
But actually, they wouldn't. So it's actually more about a relationship than it is anything to do with the dirty bombs in Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think that's definitely just the backdrop to it. I don't think that there's any direct link to the World Trade Center or rehashing terrorist attacks that's happened so far. I mean, it's definitely a possibility, which is unfortunate in the world we live in today. But it could have been a hurricane. It could have been an earthquake. It's more of dealing with the lack of preparation with governments and the chaos that ensues when something terrible like that would happen.
Does that make it quite an uncomfortable film to make?
It was extremely uncomfortable. It was mentally draining, emotionally draining. I'm glad it was a short shoot because otherwise I'd probably have to check myself into a mental institution. I don't know if you've seen the film.
Or I haven't, no. Oh. Can you explain why?
High intensity. You know, you have sort of that situation, and to make it believable and realistic, you're dealing with a lot of emotions there. And to sustain that for the whole shoot, I think we had one scene in the beginning, which was sort of like a nice, loving scene, and then the rest was just completely chaotic.
Now, the director is Chris Gorak. This is his debut, yes?
Yeah, yeah. He's been an art director for guys like Fincher and Spielberg and a lot of big sort of name guys. And these producers, Jonah and Palmer, asked him to write something because they thought he was a very bright guy, and he is a bright guy. And he came to them with this, and they said, sure, let's run with it.
Has this come out at the right time or the wrong time? Because if it's actually really a relationship movie, it's come out. Obviously, we've had United 93's World Trade Center. It's the anniversary of September 11 coming up, the fifth anniversary. Is that helpful or not?
I think this movie is very different from those movies. Those movies are sort of rehashing events that have already happened. This is sort of a fictional could-be premise. And it doesn't necessarily exploit the fears of people in that way. I think it's just more, like I said before, that it's just a human story about two people dealing with a tragedy that happens and the sort of hardships that follow.
We were just talking to Jeremy Thomas, the producer, just before the news, and we had quite a long chat about Richard Linklater. Who you've worked with on a number of occasions, Dazed and Confused,
yeah,
and Scanner Darkly. Yeah. So can you just, because I've never met the guy, but read all these extraordinary things, the movies that he makes, never mind School of Rock, what a fantastic film that was. What is it that Richard Linklater does that makes you want to go back and work with him?
Well, Richard's kind of it's such a laid-back, relaxed guy, and I think he's very intelligent and just sort of hires people that he feels are capable of doing the jobs that he sets him in position to do, whether it be the director of photography or the, you know, everybody all the way down the line, the actors. And, you know, he makes it a comfortable work environment. So, and I think he has, you know, good diversity and taste in his material that he does.
Dazed and Confused, if I remember right. Yeah. This is Mark, who's our film critic.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Didn't do spectacularly well at the box office here, but then was one of those movies that does well on video.
Big video
well
hit, DVD. Yeah. I mean, it happens so often that movies that have what we now refer to as a cult following are discovered on the small screen. Then again, when you bear in mind that the ratio of how many movies get seen in the cinemas, how many movies get seen at home nowadays is something like 1 to 6 or 7, you know, doing big on video is very, very important. The thing I remember most about Dazed and Confused was the fact that you couldn't get Dazed and Confused for the soundtrack because Zeppelin wouldn't relinquish the rights to it. And of course, Linklater had this whole thing for ages and ages about getting Zepp in his movie, which is why when School of Rock happened, there is finally the Zeppelin track after Jack Black made this personally recorded message for Plant and Page saying, please,
well,
give us the rights to it.
Jimmy Page saw Dazed and Confused and signed off and said, you can have the Led Zeppelin music, you know, the song.
Yeah.
And Robert Plant, I guess, was in his sobriety, didn't appreciate the, you know, substance abuse, so he didn't sign off. So that's why we couldn't get the... But I was glad that they had the Aerosmith song.
Oh, yeah. No, it's just one of those sort of funny things in which you just assume that Dazed and Confused has got Dazed and Confused in it, but it didn't suffer for not having it.
This question from Madoop, who says, Sam, could you ask Rory why he got killed off from CSI Miami, even though, I bet you've never been asked this before, even though the episode he was killed off in was actually one of the best episodes of CSI Miami. It's good to have Mark back, by the way. It was also good to have Rory back. So what happened there?
I did that show for 2 years and sort of got tired of the monotony of doing the DNA in the lab and let's get this back to the lab and so forth. And I know it was a very popular show, and it still is. I just, as an actor, like to try to do different things. Keeps you alive, keeps your sort of soul going. Mm. Whether they pay you or they don't pay you, you know, they pay you well on those shows. But
you were bored.
Yeah. So I asked to be killed off. The way they did it, I wasn't too happy about it. Like, you know, I'm an idiot because my gun jams and then they shoot me. But you got to do what you got to do, and I'm not in charge of those decisions.
I'm listening very closely to your voice, and I can't hear any trace of English at all. But didn't you go to school here, or were you brought up here many years ago?
I lived in Cambridge for 8 years. I was born in New York, lived there from 3 months to 8 years old.
No, can't hear any just American all the way up.
I think his accent says Cambridge. I just think it just rings Cambridge scholarship, don't you think?
Absolutely.
I used to go punting and all that
punting
kind of crap.
Excellent.
Steve in Lanark says, I realise this is academic now, and I was anxious to hear what Mark had to say about A Scanner Darkly. It was a bit of a rush job 2 weeks ago, so wasn't reviewed, and the temp ignored it last week.
The what?
With the temp. Now, I have to say, what happened was last week is that James was in position. We're about to do lots of movie stuff, and then there was an ICC cricket conference in which was fairly extraordinary, so it kind of all disappeared. Stuff went off. So while Rory is here on the assumption that there's some good stuff to say about it, Scanner Darkly?
Yeah, it's a very, very difficult film, because I'm particular about Philip Dick. You know, I made a documentary about Blade Runner, and Philip Dick is one of those people who is famously unfilmable. And, of course, what Linklater chose to do was to use the easiest shorthand for it is this, it's a kind of new form of rotoscoping whereby you act the part and then the acted role is then animated over. He used it in Waking Life. And it gives you this very strange quality of film, which is somewhere between real and animation. It has a very sort of dreamlike quality to it. Now, of course, for Dick, that's very appropriate. And I think probably in terms of the adaptations of Dick on film, it is the most faithful and the one that comes closest to capturing Dick's spirit. The downside of that is that if you're familiar with Dick's work, you'll know that it's not mainstream. It's not something that just wins over a huge audience. He's a very, very... I mean, for a start, he was as paranoid as anything, and he's a very difficult writer sometimes to get your head around. And I think that what happens with Scanner Darkly is it does justice to Dick's text with all its difficulties. I don't think there's any way you'd expect that. I mean, I saw it in Cannes, which, of course, is a very difficult place to see any movie at all. And it really is, you could feel your brain being scrunched around as it happens. I mean, I have to say, on first screening, it's a film that I admired rather than liked. I would like to see it again, partly because I do think the idea of doing Dick in that way is bold and ambitious. That's not to say it's an easy... I don't think you'd say it was an easy watch.
No, I mean, I tell people all the time it's the type of film that you can't go into go into it with the pretense that it's some sort of silly cartoon. I think it's a very cerebral picture, and I think that you need to see it a couple of times to really grasp the whole thing.
I mean, Dick absolutely lived in the realm of the paranoid, and it's, getting inside his head is a very, very strange place to be, and I think that Linklater does succeed in doing that. What it's like in there, is not necessarily very easy.
What are you in next, Rory, after this has been and gone? Not implying that it's going to go very quickly.
Thanks. I'm doing I think I mentioned that the Ridley Scott miniseries thing. So that's sort of a big production.
And Ridley Scott is, of course, one of the great directors to work with. Not only a very good director, but also, at least on the very few times I've met him, he'd be a thoroughly decent chap who smokes a cigar the whole time.
That'll be an interesting
experience.
I think
that's a good thing. I think directors should smoke cigars. I think more of them should wear jodhpurs as well.
As a movie sort of anecdote, it didn't pass muster, really, but
no.
it'll do for now. Rory, thanks very much indeed for coming in.
Thanks
and,
for having me.
Right at your door opens... Rory thinks next
Friday.
Week.
It is definitely next Friday, because I'm seeing it on Monday, so that means it opens next Friday.
Hey, Rory, thanks very
Thank
much.
You.
Sleep
Thank
well.
You.
So, reviews of Crank and Little Man and The Sentinel, The Wicker Man... And this
The Wicker Man,
which
incidentally, they didn't show the critics, okay? But that hasn't stopped me.
At number 10, this is Box Office Top 10 at the moment. At 10, Nacho Libre.
Jack Black in a leotard, falling over, doing a funny foreign comedy accent and some wrestling. Men in tights. I mean, it's not a masterpiece. It doesn't have the wit of Napoleon Dynamite, which its director made before, but I did laugh more than six times.
Number 9, Miami Vice.
Now, I got a phone call from you last night saying, should I or shouldn't I go and see this or Superman? And I said, Superman's a better movie, but the second half of Miami Vice makes up. So which one did you go
see?
We
went to see Miami Vice.
And what do you think?
Oh, I enjoyed it.
The
second half, once they take out the
raid,
the punks
happens
in the caravan.
Exactly.
That's very good. A little bit too much Rumpy Pumpy if you're going to see it with your 15-year-old. I would say.
I did warn you of that.
And is it part one? Because there are a number of things that weren't cleared up.
No.
Like, where does the leak come from?
No.
They set the whole thing up by saying, there's a leak coming from somewhere, we're not sure, you guys had better go and sort it out. Well, they fail. They never sort that out.
The whole of the first half of the movie, you have no idea, because they just go, hey, see it? Okay. And then this one brilliant interview, and Michael Mann said, they told me I was really stupid when I did the scene with the speedboat. They said, you can't have a conversation with two guys in a speedboat moving at 100 miles an hour, and you can't hear what they're saying. You know what? They were right. You can't. But it doesn't make any difference, because halfway through the movie, and it's exactly the halfway point, the raid thing happens, and then bang, then it's action.
Yeah, but it's kind of a key plot point is the fact that Crockett and Tubbs are sent in there to sort out this situation because there's a leak. So some information is being leaked, and it's never sorted as to where that comes from.
No, but who cares? Because the plot's really not that relevant. The plot is not relevant at all. It's just once it gets into the set pieces. But you see what I mean about the second half of the movie. You want to go see Miami Vice, right? Buy your ticket, go out for a coffee for the first half, and come in at the beginning of the road, which I think is like 55 minutes in.
Volver, if that's how you say it, at 8.
They did it, Volver. I really liked it. It's returning, you know, in Spanish. I thought it was Almodovar's best film in a long time. I think it's a really interesting, lovely, heartwarming, semi-ghost story, and I liked it very much in Cannes. I was staggered in Cannes when it didn't win the Palme d'Or, when the Ken Loach did, because much as I liked or admired the Ken Loach, I didn't think it had a cat in hell's chance of winning. And I would have put my money on the Almodovar.
I know you've been in America for a bit. There's no reason to start saying semi.
What did I say? Semi?
Semi?
No, that's horrible.
Semi ghost.
Actually, no,
story.
I'm sorry. That's really horrible. That is exactly it.
Severance, which is about the only movie that we did get to talk about last week before the ICC started revealing shocking things. Severance is at 7.
Yeah, kind of all right, horror-y stuff. You know, nothing to write home about, but it's okay.
John Tucker Must Die at 6.
One of the best things about being away last week was I didn't see it. So did it get reviewed?
Nothing got reviewed last week.
Oh, nothing got reviewed. No, well, I haven't seen it. I'm going to go and see it this week. So that I haven't seen, nor, and I'll warn you in advance, have I seen You, Me and Dupree, because last week I didn't see any films.
The UK's number one film.
Well, hey, that's fine.
Monster House at 5?
It's, you know, quite good fun as far as the animations this summer is concerned. It's one of the better ones.
Cars at 4?
I like the design of it. I think the characters have got something, you know, lacking. I don't think it has anything like the classic timeless appeal of the best Pixar stuff. I think the worst thing you can say about it is that it's technically very well accomplished, and I never thought I'd say that about a Pixar film, because you're not meant to notice the technical accomplishment.
3 is Pirates of the Caribbean. Now, this email from Peter says, Good Dr. Venture, guess why the general film going public are such poor judges of film. 2 examples. Dead Man's Chest is now the 4th biggest grossing film of all time.
Is it?
And overheard at the cinema today, without a hint of irony, let's see Little Man. It looks really funny. No, says Peter, it makes Eternity with the Crankies seem like a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, I have to tell you, I'll say this in advance of the review. If you go see Little Man, shame on you. Shame on you. In the same, because if you, no, I'm sorry, I'm deadly serious about this. If you pay money to see, I mean, I have seen some offensive films in my life. I've seen I Spit in Your Grave, Cannibal Holocaust, I Eat Your Skin, Cannibal Ferox, SS Experiment. I mean, I have seen, believe me.
That's One Night in Your House.
If you fund those people, shame on you. We'll get to the review later on, but I want to make this absolutely clear. There is no excuse for seeing Little Man.
If I've already seen it?
Well, you know, shame on you already.
Okay, so that review coming up.
Coming
we haven't even mentioned The Wicker Man. Snakes on a Plane at 2.
You know, Snakes on a Plane, rubbish, but not entirely without a couple of laughs. I mean, it does look very much like a movie that's been botched together after an internet campaign took off. It's not really a film. It's a bunch of, you know, gags tied around a very old, creaky 70s disaster movie that was clearly a PG-13 and then was upped because of the internet. Again, one of those things, had they shown it to critics, it wouldn't have got half the kicking that it's probably getting as a result of them not showing it to critics. I mean, I saw it in Hollywood, actually in Man's Chinese Theatre at the 1 o'clock in the morning screening, which is the best possible way of seeing it, with a bunch of drunken fans who knew all the lines anyway, presumably because some of them had written them and then sent them in on the internet, because some of the lines in the movie were actually sent in by, you know, internet geeks. And even they started to lose interest about halfway through the movie, because there's only a certain amount of times Sam Jackson can say, you know, melon farming snakes on a melon farming plane. However, the first time he says it, it's quite funny.
And number one is the aforementioned You, Me and Dupree, which you'll see this week and report back.
Yep.
Before we get to movie number one, Bill in Oxford, in relation to our previous conversation about Crash, Cronenberg version. Dear Simon, a campaign against the film is not shameful or disgraceful, as Mark suggests. It is simply a campaign with which he disagrees.
No, actually, you're wrong. It's shameful and disgraceful. And I'll be very clear about this, and here's why. It's one thing saying that a film is terrible, awful, evil, bad, rubbish, lousy. Fine, fine, go ahead. It's another thing saying that nobody else should be able to see that film. And the campaign against Crash was disgraceful and shameful because what they tried to do was to prevent you, me, them...
Everybody,
as the, yes, exactly. Thank you very much for getting the Blues Brothers in there. I knew it was going somewhere to stop seeing it. Anybody is entitled to any opinion about any film they like, but you are not entitled to tell other people that they cannot make their mind up for themselves. And the campaign against Crash was a ban it campaign. And I'm sorry.
You have just told me, shame on me if I go and see Little
Man. I haven't said ban it. I absolutely haven't said ban it. What I've said is, if you go, shame on you.
Oh, okay.
But I'm not saying bad. And that's the difference. If what they had said was, if you go see Crash, shame on you, fine. Hey, I mean, how much shame and opprobrium can one man take? Frankly, bring it on. But don't tell me that, you know, that it's going to be banned. I mean, you can see that my usual jovial self is getting quite cross about this.
Yeah, and we haven't even mentioned The Wicker Man, which we should do.
Which they tried to... Well, they didn't show it to critics, so I paid and went to see it at the Thursday. You want to start now? We've got 3 minutes, and I don't know whether it's enough time. Shall I set it up and then we'll do the review after the news?
How long is the setup going to take?
Okay, well, we'll do the setup in the clip, okay? So the setup
Sophie
is this.
Sophie's here, she has her news ready.
Should we just do that?
Okay. No, it's not time. But she will sit and listen. When you start, we'll do the news.
You sure?
Well, it depends how long you take. If I start waving my arms or fall asleep, you'll know what to do.
Right, so The Wicker Man, a remake of the 1970s British horror movie, which is considered to be the Citizen Kane of British horror movies by some people, an extremely strange, quirky, odd, very, very frightening, very rough around the edges film. For those who haven't seen it, I'm assuming most of you have. You've seen it, Sophie, right? You've never seen The Wicker Man?
No, not yet, no.
Edward Woodward is a Puritan... policeman who is sent to a remote Scottish island. You have seen
yes,
it. It's ringing a bell.
Come back to me.
Sent to a remote Scottish
you might
island.
Remember the Bridget Bardot dancing.
It's not Bridget Bardot, it's Britt Ekland. And incidentally, it isn't even Britt Ekland because it's a body double. As she said, a big butted body double,
you
which she was
the,
very cross about.
The big butted Britt Ekland body double.
Very so scary film.
He goes to Summer Isle, which is ruled over by Christopher Lee, who has basically set up a pagan society.
You're talking about the original now.
The original.
Why are you talking about
because
that?
Because you asked me about the original. I'm setting it up, okay? There's no point discussing the original without discussing the remake, without discussing the original. He is sent there to look for a little girl who he believes has gone missing. He discovers that the entire community is part of a pagan religion, and the whole thing climaxes in a very strange way with this confrontation with the Wicker Man. The Wicker Man being a huge, great big effigy, which is used for sacrifices, theoretically used for sacrifices by pagan culture. Actually, if you know anything about pagan culture and Roman religion, you find out that's not true at all. But, you know, that's a whole other story. So it's a very odd little film with a very odd British history. It was cut down to be released as a B feature, went out as a second feature with Don't Look Now, then restored over the years, much infighting amongst the crew. I made a documentary about it. And I've never come across such hostility in a documentary between people who made the film. It's got a lot, but there's something mephitic and interesting about that film. Now, along comes the American remake. Have we really got time to do this?
It's great to have you using mephitic back.
Thank you. Yeah, I know, but didn't I get an absolute ruling that that's okay?
I don't know.
I did.
There were weeks of correspondence.
There were, but, you know, it's back on again. Now we have an American remake, because what that film really needed was an American remake, directed by Neil LaBute.
Tell you what we'll do. We'll pause it there, because you've set it up, as indeed you did say, but as it's exactly 3:30.
Can I just do one thing before the setup, which is just going to make the setup perfect, okay? When we're making the documentary about The Wicker Man, Anthony Schaefer, who wrote the screenplay for The Wicker Man, is Anthony Schaefer's The Wicker Man, said to me, and we interviewed him just before his death. It was very sad. He died when we were making the documentary. And he said, I've just had this letter in saying that the remake is going to be directed by a guy called Neil LaBute. Have you heard of him? And I said, yeah, he's a really good director. And he said, oh, well, that's great. That bodes really well.
This is a podcast from BBC Radio's news and sports station,
5 Live.
To find out more about 5 Live and its sister service, 5 Live Sports Extra, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5Live.
Mark Kermode is here. Movie conversation between now and 4 o'clock. So part one of the Wicker Man conversation was the setup in which we heard what a great movie, what a fascinating little strange British movie it was. And and how it Anthony Schaefer was thinking, great, look, it's
Neil
in Labute, safe hands.
Interesting guy. So what he's done is he's taken the Christian versus pagan allegory of the original film and turned it into a men versus women allegory in the second film. This time, Nick Cage is the American cop who is contacted to go out to a remote island. I mean, there aren't that many remote islands around the coast of America, but they have found a remote island where a matriarchal cult is ruling the island. He's not religious, but he is a man. The women are all ruled over by a woman played by Ellen Burstyn. Now, because I have a great fondness for Ellen Burstyn, because as you will, of course, know, Simon, Ellen Burstyn plays the mother in The Exorcist. I think she's a very fine actress indeed. Here, therefore, rather than Edward Woodward and Christopher Lee in the original, are Nicolas Cage and Ellen Burstyn in the remake of The Wicker Man. Now, you'll notice the very clever cine-literate gag in there, Rowan Woodward. The child's missing surname is Woodward, and Nicolas Cage's character's first name is Edward. So that's a nod to Edward Woodward, who was incidentally offered a small part in the film, which he declined, although he said he thought the script was quite interesting. A couple of things that rang alarm bells. The first one was that the BBFC gave the film a 12A rating. And the original Wicker Man was an X-rated film and was scary as anything. I mean, there are very few people who can have seen the last 20 minutes of The Wicker Man, which is really, really chilling. I don't think it's a brilliantly directed film by any means, but the original, with all its quirks, with all its oddities, with all its flaws, there is something really, really powerful about it, particularly in that last 20 minutes when it has a real sense of pagan ritual, a real sense of a clashing of two religious ethoses, one, you know, pagan, one Christian. In the remake, the very fact that it's a 12A tells you pretty much what you need to know. It's a film that's suitable for kids, and hey, that's just not good enough for a Wicker Man remake. The problems are manifold. One of them is, firstly, we have to establish that there's an island off the coast of modern America that has no contact at all with the modern world. So every 5 minutes, Nicolas Cage wanders around getting his mobile phone out to remind us that there is no mobile phone signal there. There's no electricity, no mobile phone signal. Although, strangely, at the beginning of the movie, when he looks the place up, they do have a website. So they haven't got phones, they haven't got electricity, but they have got a website. That was nice that they sorted that out in the beginning. He then gets to the island. In the original film, there is something very strange about the villagers, but they're all recognisably strange. In the remake, no, they're just all completely... They've clearly landed from a Star Trek episode. You remember that Star Trek episode, in fact, when William Shatner lands on the planet that is entirely run by women? It's like an episode of Star Trek in the drawing of the characters. All the strangeness, all the weirdness, all the oddness, all that really, really genuinely down-to-earth sense of the original has gone completely, and we are just walking around in Ooga Booga land. Thirdly, Nicolas Cage, with the best will in the world, is not Edward Woodward. One of the reasons the first Wicker Man is so good is that Edward Woodward's performance is extraordinary. He gives a really great performance as an uptight, puritanical policeman who suddenly comes face-to-face with this religion that he cannot deal with at all. And you really believe in his character. And when the awful denouement is revealed, the ghastliness of it all is completely filtered through Edward Woodward's reactions. With the best will in the world, the horse-faced Nicolas Cage going, "Oh, no!" is just Nicolas Cage going, "Oh, no!" He does, however, have the best line in the movie when he pulls his gun and says, "Madam, step away from the bicycle." And for that alone, it is almost worth seeing. But you get to the end
of it. Why does she have to step away from the bicycle, just out of interest?
Well, because he's a cop and he's commandeering her vehicle, but they're on the island where there's no thing, so the bicycle is the motor. I mean, I think it must have been intended to be funny.
A possessed bicycle?
No, a bicycle. He needs the bicycle. It's like, "Sir, step away from the car," but he's in Summer's Isle, so she has to step away from the bicycle. In order to keep the action potential up, I mean, they've obviously made the film and realised how dull it is. So every 5 minutes, he falls through a ceiling and, you know, almost falls down. He gets attacked by killer bees. He almost drowns. There's lots of killer bees in the film. All of these things feel like, oh, the movie's really plodding. Let's do something with Nicolas Cage. Let's throw him off a cliff. Let's set some killer bees in him. Because what they know is nothing is happening until we get to the end. And then you get to the end. And the end, if you've seen the original, the extraordinary set piece with the Wicker Man, and they redo it in the remake, and you go, "That's really boring. That's really, really uninspiring and uneventful. And you know what? I don't care." And then it's so limp and so lacking in any sort of magic and so lacking in any kind of dramatic force that they have to do a kind of payoff-y epilogue to make it work. And none of it makes sense. None of it adds up. None of it is convincing. None of it has any justification for existing whatsoever. And I speak as somebody who went in with as high expectations as it was possible to have. Because, as I said before, I don't think the original Wicker Man is a perfect film. I think there is loads of things wrong with it. That's one of the reasons I like it, incidentally, because there are so many things wrong with it, because it was made under such shockingly tight budget conditions, because it was made with so much tension going on around the film itself. And when Neil LaBute said, you know what, it's the kind of film that you can reapproach and you can bring a different story to it, you think, yes, that's a great idea. Terrific. Go for it. And then you sit there in the cinema and you go, no, it's just so wet. And it's just Nicolas Cage and Ellen Burstyn in a frock and a guy with a box of matches. And put your mobile phone away, Nicolas. I know there's no mobile signal. And then at the very end, incidentally, his mobile rings after they've spent 80 minutes convincing you that there is no mobile signal in this place. And you just wander out thinking, oh, well, there we go. Another great 70s horror movie.
Spoiler.
Bites the dust.
Andy, on this, does the new Wicker Man use the original soundtrack? I would guess
no.
Not, but cannot imagine separating the on-screen action from that quirky music.
It's absolutely true, and of course the music is so much a part of the original. At one point they were going to do a stage show musical of the Wicker Man, and of course, for those who know the original, the extraordinary thing at the ending, when you've got this whole crowd of bonkers villagers, but recognisably bonkers villagers, standing around singing, "Summer is a-coming in," and you know, even just doing it then, I've made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. I've just done it to myself. It's incredible. But in the film, you know, there's just nothing going on. And the score is by Angelo Badalamenti. Angelo Badalamenti is a great composer, but here it's just like, oh, I've got something in the back drawer, it's a bit sinister. There you go, have that.
This from Declan says, I apologise for my off-topicness, as it's not related specifically to today's programme. Well, you're wrong, actually.
Cool.
I wonder if you could let the good Dr. Kermode know that there is a new website dedicated to The Wicker Man, the original 1973 one.
There are several websites
dedicated.
The reason
for asking is that I know from some of Mr. K's previous work that he had a keen eye for Wicker Man trivia. And of the highest order, and perhaps he will find the content interesting. Then again, maybe he won't. And it's wicker-man.com.
Can I just say, there are several Wicker Man websites. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about that movie is, for a movie that was cut down and basically reduced to B-movie status when it was first made, its entire life since then has happened through fans and through fanzines, and more recently through websites and through the extraordinary devotion. I mean, there is a very fine book written about it by a journalist called Alan Brown, called Inside the Wicker Man, which is everything you know, ever or never wanted to know about the Wicker Man, and it's, you know, it's extremely thorough. And the people who are devoted to that film are really devoted to it.
This is Five Lives, quarter to four. Big movies coming up. Well, they're big, you know, there's lots of posters for them. Whether they're any good or not, Mark will tell you. We'll try and fit in three reviews at least before 4 o'clock. We've done Wicker Man, Little Man, Crank and The Sentinel. We had Michael Douglas on a few days ago. So,
oh, yeah. He was nice.
He was a very nice, pleasant kind of chap. Hmm. Find out about the movie in a moment. What do you want to do next?
Little Man, and I'm going to take a deep breath about this. Little Man is the latest Wayans brothers comedy, and it stars Marlon Wayans as a small person, midget, dwarf, whatever the correct term currently is. Now, one of the reasons I'm slightly confused about what the correct term is because obviously the press notes for the movie aren't particularly reliable. When I was talking to Matthew Bright, who made a film about little people, as he was referring to them, he was referring to something called the American Convention of Little People, and that seemed at that time to be the correct terminology, but I think it comes and goes. Okay, so basically the story is that he's a little guy, and he gets out of prison, and he's 3 foot tall, and in order to stay away and out of trouble from some gang members, he has to pretend to be a baby. And he turns up on the door of a house, and they think he is a baby. And the way they've done this is that they have digitally transposed Marlon Wayans' head onto the body of a 2.5 foot tall 9-year-old. And that's pretty much the setup of the movie. Now, here's the thing. The movie's billed as a comedy. And I would say right at the beginning that to say that there were no laughs in it is really to understate the level of the no laughter. The movie has a message. It has several messages. And the messages are pretty much as follows. Firstly, little people are really funny because they look like babies. And that's hilarious. Secondly, they're really funny because they look like babies, but, you know, with grown-up attachments. And that's really, really hilarious. Thirdly, however, they're not that funny. So in order to make them funny, we have to superimpose the head of Marlon Wayans onto the body of a 9-year-old little person to create the thing that we think is funny, which doesn't exist in the real world, but we think it's funny anyway. Fourthly, breastfeeding is absolutely hilarious, and it's all to do with sex, and boy, the laughs just never stop. Fifthly, if you're a woman, please quit your job immediately and go back to having children, because that's what you're meant to do. I lost track of the number of people, sane, sentient, open-minded people who should have been offended by Little Man. I take no pleasure in saying this. I have seen some films that I consider to be grotesque, but I struggle to think of one more grotesque than Little Man. It is, in every way, evil-minded, bad, you know, profoundly depressing indictment of the way in which the modern movie industry works. I mean, one of the saddest things is that the Wayans brothers have actually become the most successful black filmmakers of all time, financially speaking, which ought to be something about which one can celebrate. But it is the most retrograde, horrible, nauseating, inward-looking, smug, repulsive, grotesque, ill-advised, badly judged,
patronizing.
Well, no,
I haven't seen it. I mean, offering you
no patronizing. Help. I mean, you sit there thinking, is it me or is everyone in the cinema taking a collective breath and thinking, you can't really have made this film. You really cannot have sat in script meetings and decided that this was a good idea. I was very reassured today to read a couple of reviews in newspapers, all one stars, all saying exactly the same thing, saying that there is no pit deep enough in the world to dispose of every single copy of this film. It is, and I say this seriously, it is evil. And if you go and see it, shame on you.
It's not, how can you mean it's offensive?
I mean, it's evil.
What do you mean?
I mean, there is such a thing.
In what way is it evil?
I mean, there is such a thing
by
as
the devil,
good
is it?
And evil. Well, listen, I've spent my whole life defending movies that people tell me are evil, okay? And they're not. And, you know, I get told horror movies are bad for you and action movies are bad for you and, you know, erotic thrillers are bad for you. No, Little Man is bad for the world. It's bad for the whole world that
it exists. Is it possessed by the devil?
You want an honest answer to that question?
Yeah.
Yes.
Put it on the poster. Peter on this says, I'm absolutely at one with Mark on Little Man. I nearly walked out, blah, blah, blah. It's truly hideous, but I often envy Mark's job lounging around in cinemas all day, doing 2 hours work on a Friday afternoon. You're right, Peter, that is all it is. But not when he has to watch rubbish like that. Andrew Manchester watched Little Man in Australia 3 weeks ago on a rugby tour. Host managed to get us in for free, although we may have got someone fired. Anyway, our team all fell asleep, but the Aussies enjoyed it. To make things worse, though, they murdered us the next day, 39-7.
That'll go on the poster. The Aussies enjoyed it.
Yeah. But it's actually, is it the first film you've seen that's possessed by the devil, do you think?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously I use that phrase very, very selectively. I mean, I seriously think it's the most wretched, rancid thing. I mean, I have seen some bad films in my life, and I'm sure...
You would rather go and see Pirates of the Caribbean, both as a double bill, than see this again.
I would rather see Pirates of the Caribbean on a continuous loop for an entire weekend with my eyes held open like Malcolm McDowell enduring the Ludovico technique in A Clockwork Orange than watch Little Man again.
Context has been supplied.
Okay.
What else?
Crank.
Now, we're going to play a clip. But when we play a clip, it's got lots of bleeps in it, which is appropriate. I hope it's got enough bleeps.
Well, I'll tell you what, since we've only got 6 minutes, should we just skip over it?
No, play the clip.
Okay, Crank. So the story is, you know Speed, right? You know Speed?
The movie?
Yeah, the movie. Yes. Yep. Okay. And the thing is, there's a bus. There's a bomb on the bus. Yes. The bus goes over 40 miles an hour? Is it 50 miles an hour? And then if they go below 50 miles an hour, everything will end. It'll be terrible. Well, Crank is Speed, except Jason Statham is the bus. At the beginning of the movie, he is injected with a high cocktail. You know Jason Statham? Yeah. He's the guy from the Guy Ritchie movie. He's the guy who talks like that. I'm Jason Statham, and every movie I'm in, this is the voice I do. And I have been injected with a cocktail of Chinese drugs, which means that if I go below 50 miles an hour, I will die. On the basis of that, were I injected with the same cocktail of drugs that he was injected, I would have died about the 25-minute mark. Because there's 25 minutes in which you think, this is so stupid, it's actually quite funny. He has to stay hyped up. Therefore, he has to drive fast. He has to get into fights. He has to do the rude thing with his girlfriend in a street because he has to do anything to keep him going because he's Jason Statham and that's what he's got. And, of course, if you saw Revolver, which is basically a similar film. In fact, there is one scene which almost seems to take the mick out of that terrible scene in Revolver in which Jason Statham has a row with himself in the lift. Well, the whole of this film is Jason Statham having a row with the whole of the rest of the world. The problem is, it's funny for 25 minutes and then you go... and then it's all over. But for the 25 minutes that it is funny, it is quite funny. And there is something about Jason Statham. I mean, boy, he likes to take his clothes off in movies. And he likes to run around with his butt on display. So there is a whole section of the movie which he's running around in a hospital gown with his butt on display. You remember that film he made, not The Enforcer, The Protector, when for no reason at all, about two-thirds of the way through, he strips down to his underwear and has an oily fight with some strapping young men. For no good reason at all, other than, of course, if I look like
Jason
Statham.
Should I get that one
out
for the weekend?
You should do. It's, you know, it's...
Mother-in-law's coming down.
Exactly.
There, my dear.
Something for the weekend, sir. Okay. But it's 25 minutes of interesting, and after that, it's complete pants. The Sentinel, the new movie starring Michael Douglas. You had him on the programme. Apparently, he was quite nice. Story is Michael Douglas... Well, he probably did this for you. Michael Douglas is an agent who is protecting the president. There has been a threat upon the president's life. Do you want me to play a clip, or should I just do this? Because
just do it.
Fine. There's been a threat upon the president's life. Somebody within the Secret Service is plotting against the president, and suspicion falls upon Michael Douglas, who is acting suspiciously. But the reason he's acting suspiciously is not because he is plotting against the president's life, but because he, being Michael Douglas, is having a strumpy with the president's wife, played by Kim Basinger, who spends the whole movie doing that Kim Basinger look of, you know, slightly, oh, a little bit, ooh, a little bit, hmm. And every time she sees Michael Douglas, is, oh.
So he, really?
Yes, exactly.
You really shouldn't with the president's wife.
No, you shouldn't. It is, he is definitely endangering the president. I mean, you know, he is the president's closest aide. He is meant to be protecting the president from all manner of nastiness. But unfortunately, he himself has trodden over the line. Now, the film itself, fairly dull. It's most obviously related to In the Line of Fire, the Clint Eastwood movie, which it's not a patch on. The Clint Eastwood movie was actually, you know, rather fun, had nice edge to it. Clint Eastwood made more jokes about being the age that he is. John Malkovich is the psycho, yes.
Yeah,
John Malkovich, is who was doing his then trademark psycho role. This is nothing like that. Has none of the... It's actually rather dull. The only interesting thing about it is every now and then you get to see Michael Douglas running and you think... Blimey, shouldn't you sit down?
How far can you keep this going?
Exactly, you should, you know, have a so
I mentioned to Michael Douglas because he was the American president in 1995.
Yes, and he's now being demoted. Benning, to,
you know, so yeah. He's got, going in the wrong direction, isn't he, really?
Well, you know, one can play any role if one plays it well, and he plays this just in that sort of standard boring. You know how you play a Secret Service agent? You put on dark glasses, you put something in your ear, you talk to your collar, and every now and then you shout, and that's exactly what he does, and the film isn't great.
I think you talk to your cuff.
Talk to your cuff, what did I say?
Talk to your collar.
Collar, sorry, cuff, the thing on the end of your arm. So can I very quickly say, in the last few minutes, the film of the week, it's a very small release, is This Film Is Not Yet Rated, a film by Kirby Dick about the terribly bad organisation of the American rating system. What Kirby Dick does, and I'm just going to tell you this as it's enough, Kirby Dick, in order to undermine the American Ratings Board, who consists of this entirely anonymous group of people who claim to be ordinary parents who rate movies in America, claim to be ordinary parents, what he does is he sets a lesbian detective agency upon them to discover who they actually are. And in the process...
Lesbian detective?
Yeah,
well, there really is one?
Yeah, there really is, and they're in Kirby Dick's very funny movie, which reveals some very serious truths about how lousy film ratings are in England, and reminds us once again how lucky we are to have, and I say this very seriously, the best film classification board in the world in the shape of the BBFC.
James says, I bet I'd just laugh more during the Good Doctor's review of Little Man than I would do if I went to see it. Not that I ever planned to. The trailer convinced me of all things that Mark had just said. So, movie of the week is The Film Is Not Yet Rated. Everything else sounds pretty pants.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.